Hello, this is your host, Mike Petrilli, the Thomas B. Fordham Institute, here at the Education Gadfly Show and online at edexcellence.net. Now, please join me in welcoming my co-host, the Sonia Sotomayor of the education policy world, Rick Hess.
Hey, Mike, how you doing, Beb?
I'm well. How are you doing?
Very many, Beb.
You know, if I had to appoint somebody to the Supreme Court from the education policy wonk world, you'd be on my short list.
Dude, I'm touched.
Yeah, yeah. Although there's an issue here about diversity right now. I mean, mm-hmm. We know that Sonia is Sotomayor, Justice Sotomayor. That's how we refer to her right now. Would be the first Hispanic. She would be, I believe, the sixth Catholic on the mm-hmm. court out of nine. There are then two Jews, and then only one WASP. Mm-hmm. And so that some people have said this is a real crisis in terms of diversity.
So, as a Catholic, you feel okay about it.
I do. Yeah, recovering Catholic. Yes, but but speaking of Catholics, so she we are now hearing about her life story. She went to Catholic schools in New York City, as did Clarence Thomas. He went to Catholic schools. So now, if she is confirmed, that would mean the two minority members of the Supreme Court came through Catholic schools. And so maybe, I don't know, could this be a rallying cry for saving our Catholic schools?
if one really, really stretches.
Rick, it's not much of a stretch. Look, I mean, to get to the highest court of the land, it's a huge accomplishment. And you could say, look, what was critical for these two justices, the only two justices, I think, on the court that really come from disadvantaged backgrounds, was getting to go to Catholic schools. And now those Catholic schools are disappearing in the very neighborhoods where the next generation of poor kids live. I don't think it's much of a stretch. You just need a little imagination, Rick.
Hey, I hear Fordham's been getting some unsolicited mail, huh?
You're right. We did get, we got a book in the mail, the latest Chubb Moe book, mm-hmm. and the Hoover folks that were promoting it, they sent one here for Margaret Spellings, who I understand they must believe works at Fordham because of our April Fool's Day gladfly.
So she wants to come and pick it up from you?
I told her, Margaret, come on by anytime you want. Nice. Grab a cup of coffee. All right, we got lots to cover today, Rick. I know you've been slacking off out mm-hmm. there gallivanting about, but we work hard here on the show to bring our listeners the latest news and views in education. We're going to have our Pardon the Gadfly mm-hmm. Segment. Then we're going to hear the Research Minute with Amber, and we're going to have Stafford rate that reform.
Mm-hmm.
If her laryngitis isn't too bad.
Rate that, baby.
Rate it. Rate it. Last week, you missed it. We smacked it.
We did.
Excuse me?
We did. Okay, Christina, let's get started.
Please. Okay, the New York Times reports that the city's newest principals, of which there are lots, are quite younger, better paid, and less experienced in the classroom than their veteran peers. And some test scores seem to indicate that these younger principals are less effective, too. What does this mean about the strategy of recruiting non-traditional leaders?
A strategy promoted by, more than anybody else, Rick Hess, mm-hmm. over the years.
Well, so I'm not familiar with the article. Lisa Gutman wrote it, I believe.
Well, you don't read anymore, Rick?
I was on vacation.
All right.
But let's get straight. So when we say that the principals' schools are performing worse than other principals, mm-hmm. is this that since these principals have taken the helm, we have seen declines in student achievement? Or is that, I believe it's not as refined as that.
I believe all she looked at were the letter grades given out by the city to these schools that is based mostly in value-added scores. So these schools that the principals are leading aren't making as much gains as the schools run by veteran principals. I believe that's what she was showing.
Mm.
I have to admit, I only skimmed the article myself. It was over the holiday. Go
ahead. there's a couple things going on. First, the fact that you can hire non-traditionals doesn't necessarily mean you're going to make the right hire. So sure, it's possible that these aren't the right people. More fundamentally, the senior principals, Mike, as you've pointed out, who've survived the Klein purge, one might very well think are not representative of the broader class of principals as a whole.
So in other words, the best ones remained.
That's possible.
And you would expect that good principals with a lot of experience would be better at running a school than
new principals. Wouldn't it be a terrible surprise?
Okay.
But then the other question is, what exactly claim is being made on behalf of these new principals? Certainly John Schnur says, look, the only metric that matters is whether or not these student test scores are pumping up. As I keep saying, I think this is a limited set of metrics. Sure, for particularly kids in a city like New York City, where a lot of kids are just behind the eight ball, making sure that the kids' test scores are going up is an important thing. But that is hardly the argument for the only skill set or the only useful thing that these guys bring to the schoolhouse.
Topic number two.
Whoa, Mike, reaction?
You were just kind of long-winded there, Rick. So I have to
zing.
Look, sure, I guess that that, you know, but you sound a little bit like an ed school professor there, you know, excusing away the low test scores. I mean, look, I think it's possible. I think we have to be aware that it's possible. In New York City, at least, where there was a tradition of some excellent educators in that system for a long time, perhaps unlike some of the other big urban districts, that it's possible that Klein may have pushed out some really good people, encouraged people to retire who had a couple more good years in them, and that's that was a loss.
Fair enough.
All right.
Fair point.
Topic number two.
The Philadelphia Inquirer has won a public records lawsuit against a Pennsylvania charter school which didn't want to cough up detailed financial information showing what it paid for its for-profit manager and the financial innards of that for-profit company. How much financial transparency should we expect from public charter schools, from their for-profit managers?
A lot.
Sweet chili. What do you mean, baby?
A lot. I think it's just fair to expect public charter schools to open up their books quite wide. I mean, they are public institutions. They are, you know, taking taxpayer dollars. I think, you know, even if, you know, we just have an expectation, particularly in public education, but more broadly in the public world of finance, that there should be some accounting for these dollars. Now, I guess you could say that if the state contracts with some contractor to build a highway, there's some question about how much detail you're allowed to see within that contractor's budget. But, you know, you would see their proposal. You could get open records law to see how what, you know, the bid that they put in originally and how they budgeted that cost. So, I mean, I think, look, I think there should be some money. And what the Inquirer was after here, I think, is they want to know, is the for-profit company getting rich off this deal? Are people getting paid ridiculous salaries? You know, while I'm a little worried about that kind of gotcha journalism, I don't think those are unreasonable questions to ask.
I mean, I think certainly, right? I mean, certainly there's got to be some reasonable degree of transparency. Public funds, public kids, absolutely. Question is, if what the Inquirer is really pushing for is kind of proprietary information, either about how these companies execute their plans, in which case this is actually proprietary knowledge that these guys are using to make their living, or particular details which they are then going to use and which have been used in many cities to undermine, you know, honest debate about who's serving kids well, I think, you know, it sounds like the for-profit has a reason to say, look, this much information, but not all information. And without having this in front of us, it's hard for me to have any good opinion as to where the line was drawn here.
Yeah.
But I think there definitely is, you know, a reasonable line that, you know, we need to find.
Mm-hmm. What's interesting to me is, you know, of course, they would go after this school. It's local. It's there. It's an obvious target. Where the real money is being made, I suspect, is in the publishing industry. Mm-hmm. I mean, but I don't see anybody going after to try to find out how much the executives at Pearson are making every year.
Oh, much less how much Ruby Payne makes every time she goes in and does one of her, you know, $20,000 a day tutoring sessions. I would love to see, you know, some folks actually going after the dollars being made by professors and consultants.
Okay, topic number three.
A high school senior in suburban Washington, D.C. is about to graduate with a perfect attendance record from kindergarten through 12th grade. Rick, how does this make you feel about your spotty attendance record on the Education Gadfly show? And more importantly, should we be doing more to incentivize kids to make it to school more often?
So Rick, if she is the Cal Ripken of the education world, what would that make you?
I show up when I show, baby.
I'm thinking about some of those characters from Bull Durham, maybe. Is that more?
Oh, Crash Davis. Uh-huh. Oh, look at you with the movie references, woo, baby. Well. I like. Yeah, no. As Meatloaf famously said, two out of three ain't bad.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. All right, Rick. Well, let's
does that mean you don't know the song? You know, I want you. I need you. But there ain't no way I'm ever going to love you. Don't be sad. Two out of three. Ain't bad.
Wow. Listeners, that was a treat.
Mm-hmm.
That was a treat. All right. Well, let's talk about this substantively here for a second. Ooh. Should we, you know, it seems like almost a given we expect kids to miss a lot of school. I mean, some of this, of course, they're out sick. And, you know, but other times parents pull kids out of school for trips, you know, without thinking too much about it. Should we be doing more to encourage kids to be in those seats learning every day?
Well, I mean, there's a couple things going on here, right? Right. One, this whole incentivizing question is the same question we get with, say, the stuff Roland Fryer is running in D.C. and New York. And there's honest debates about that. Second, it seems absolutely positive to at least ceremonial respect this and to try to make a fuss about kids who do good. But the third question is, aren't we trying to get to a mindset where we're saying it's not about having your butt in a seat every day? It's about learning stuff. And it strikes me that, you know, that for most kids, we're nowhere close to that point. So having your butt in a seat is a useful thing, but it sure seems to me that we'd like to be moving past a place where having your butt in the seat is the first measure of success.
I bet there's a lot of homeschoolers that have perfect attendance records, too.
Whoa, look at you. We could get our friend Krista McGuire on the phone. I'll bet all four of her kids pretty much attend all the time.
That's right. I like that. All right. Well, good. Well, that's all the time we got for Pardon the Gadfly.
You going to get Nico to school every day, baby?
Every day.
Every day? Except I'm going to hold you to this.
When we go on vacation.
Uh-huh. Nice example you set there, Petrilli.
Okay. Well, it is. You have slogged through, listeners, so far, so that you can get to what you're really here for, the Research Minute. Amber.
Ooh, you're loud. How you doing?
A little loud, and your song was a little soft. And we've got some sort of garbage truck in the background.
Oh, for God's sake, can we get this going? Can we get this going?
All right.
Bring in the thunder. What do you got, Winkler?
Which, no, is not garbage. Oh, is Amber Winkler's Research Minute. What you got for us?
We have a new report out by Education Sector this week called Food for Thought, Building a High-Quality School Choice Market. It's an interesting concept paper, mind you. It's not an empirical study. Nonetheless, it highlights how the choice market can learn valuable lessons from the banking and food industries in terms of how to improve high-quality supply and demand. Aaron Dillon, the author, says that for-profit retailers and schools are alike in many ways. Both face marketplaces with inaccurate information about the needs and assets of a community, limited financial incentives to start and improve options, and limited data about the impact of choices on future health and wealth. One lesson she gleaned from these industries is the need for better information about the actual demand and profit potential for low-income areas. Example, retailers often rely on market analysis from census data to determine whether to invest in a neighborhood, but census data underestimate inner-city buying power. In fact, research has found that consumers making less than $10,000 report expenditures equivalent to 250% of their income. Consequently, these industries have shifted their focus to rely on more sophisticated neighborhood analyses to help attract development dollars. So, let's bring it back around. Like the retail industry, school choice suffers from a lack of good information, for example, about the availability of after-school services and childcare. Some education organizations profiled in the paper are now aware of this and are mapping the quality of the education market, which is one of Dillon's final recommendations, along with a few others, like the importance of starting small and making sure the community is involved. Yes, I realize that was over a minute.
Yes. And, you know, I got to say, the analysis is terrific. The takeaways, fine. But it's a neat paper.
It is a neat paper.
I can't believe how tightly you captured that.
I mean, it's a neat paper. Wow. I mean, I usually don't do like non-research empirical stuff, but it was interesting.
That's a good piece. But you really captured the juice out of it. It was like,
I appreciate it. I brought like, it.
You put the top on top of that roast
beef. Okay.
Or the turkey, I guess.
All this bubbling. It's not the neat paper minute. It's the research minute.
Mike, you're the more or less time.
Have you looked at the research lately? There's nothing there.
Excuse me, Rick. We have been publishing serious research around here while you're writing think papers for the Center for American Progress on Innovation.
Which I didn't profile.
What's the serious research that's been getting published there, sweet chill?
Our recent advanced placement survey of teachers, the first ever national survey of AP teachers.
And what do we find?
Lots of it. We talked about this weeks ago.
I know, I reviewed it weeks ago, or months ago, didn't I? Huh?
And the Loveless paper you just reviewed, that's going to be coming out soon?
I'm clued into the mighty research agenda that happens at Fordham.
Well, let me say just a little bit about the choice thing. Mm-hmm. Also this week coming out is the Condition of Education 2009. Mm-hmm. Always lots of interesting tidbits in there. One thing, very interesting.
Which I reviewed section one for them.
Very nice.
So don't tell me that I'm not plugged
in. Yes,
enough.
Rick, you're a big dog. You're a big dog. from over the last, from 93
that's
to 2007, we've seen a big increase in the number of parents saying that they've participated in public school choice. You know that over almost half of all parents say they have some sort of public school choice available to them.
Mm-hmm.
And it looks like blacks are particularly active in taking advantage of public school choice, whereas whites, they don't take advantage of public school choice as much. They just move to the neighborhood where they want to send their kid to school, which makes sense. If you think about it. I mean, that wealthier parents are going to do that moving, that less wealthy parents are going to take advantage of what they can within the public options nearby. So I just wanted to add a little bit of research here to the research minute
so
that we don't disappoint our
listeners.
All right. So, Amber, what goes along with this neat paper that you reviewed?
Well, the neat paper, since we're talking about what choice advocates can learn from the food and banking industry, we have Fats Domino with Blueberry Hill, a food song.
I found my thrill.
Oh, this is good, isn't it?
Oh, it is good.
Blueberry Hill.
This doesn't take you back to 12 Monkeys? Bruce Willis is when he's back in our time and he's sitting there with his head out the car window, sucking in the air. to the song? No?
Slightly familiar. Didn't Elvis sing it? Wasn't this a big Elvis song, too?
I don't know if Elvis sang it or not.
No. Laura is saying no. I'm just illiterate on these sorts of cultural things. But that's okay. But Amber is not...
You were snapping pretty good. I'll give you that.
Thank you. Yes, I learned that from my son, Nico. Okay, Amber, thank you for your research minute. Okay, it is now time that we rate that reform.
I'm liking it.
Stafford. Stafford is battling a cold.
I think you gave me swine flu, Mike.
I did no such thing. I don't think, at least I got myself checked out. I did.
I just like to spread rumors.
All right, what we got there, Steph?
Policy community. Okay, we have a story from San Diego, California, where the ACLU is threatening to sue the Ramona School District for prohibiting 12-year-old Natalie Jones from presenting her independent research project on Harvey Milk. For those of you who might have missed Sean Penn's stunning performance last year, Milk was one of the first openly gay elected officials when he won a seat in the San Francisco Board of Supervisors in 1977 and was assassinated along with San Francisco's mayor 11 months later. The school decided that the day before Natalie's presentation that her project fell under the school board's, quote, life and sex education policy, which mandates parental consent before students are taught about sexuality or reproduction, calling the project's topic, quote, sensitive. After the ACLU raised Cain, the school allowed Natalie to present her project during lunch to a select group of students whose parents had signed permission slips that allowed them exposure to lessons on sex or, quote, family life, human sexuality, AIDS, or sexually transmitted diseases.
Oy
is right. The issue of what belongs in our history books or who deserves historical consideration in our nation's classrooms is not a new one. So let's be clear here. Natalie's project was not on the topic of sex, family life, human sexuality, AIDS, or sexually transmitted diseases. She was presenting the life story of an activist who just happened to be gay. And the project itself, which is now posted on the San Diego's ACLU website, if any of our listeners would like to take a look, mentions Milk's orientation only insofar as it affected his policies. So I'd say the most outrageous thing in her 12-page PowerPoint is when Natalie explains that the gay rights bill introduced and championed by Milk was, quote, for a gay person to have the same rights as any other person. I'm going to give the school a C on problem definition. The problem here is not Natalie's presentation, but the school district's cowardice to use this opportunity as a teachable moment, especially when the project clearly has nothing to do with AIDS, sexually transmitted diseases, or sex. In fact, Milk sexuality is sort of a sidebar to the point of the presentation, and you can't rewrite history because you don't like it, Mount Woodson Elementary. As for execution, I'm going to give the school an F. They only told Natalie the day before her presentation that she'd not be allowed to present like all the other kids. She'd been working on this project for a month. This was such a sensitive topic, and these conversations should have happened way before Natalie was finished with the project, and then have her singled out to present during a lunch period. If the point was to sweep the project under the rug, then the school failed miserably.
Woof.
Yeah. So, Stafford, this seems to be a pattern now. We have... A bunch of
boneheaded
administrators. I mean, is this all of a sudden some sort of trend, do you think? Or is this the press is reporting on it more? I mean, what is happening out there?
I think it's Rush Limbaugh is taking over the minds of our school administrators.
But we've known there's been homophobia forever. Yeah. And if anything, it looks like the trends in our society show that, you know, more and more people are okay with gay marriage or, you know, gay rights of various sorts. I mean, this is the country's trending in the other direction. So why is it that we're seeing some of these schools pushing back?
California courts just upheld the ban on gay marriage like yesterday or the day before.
Yeah.
I don't know. I don't know if the trends really reflect the national thinking, honestly, the trends you're talking about, or the fact that we just live in an urban area that happens to be more open-minded.
Well, there you have it. What do you think, Rick? Harvey Milk?
You know, I mean... I do worry that, you know, that we tend to congratulate, or everybody likes to congratulate themselves on their own all-seeingness and all-knowingness. And, you know, it strikes me that I do the smug tone with which, say, California voters choosing not to recognize gay marriage, the smugness which gets, recognized in the Supreme Court, you know, the restraint they show when actually saying, geez, the voters of California are allowed to amend their constitution.
Yeah.
I feel like, you know what? I mean, one of the things living in a democracy is you don't always happen to like what everybody else with the majority likes. Mm-hmm. And, you know, sometimes that's the way life is.
Okay, but back to the school. So the point, I mean, so, you know, if you're a school principal, you hear this thing. I mean, here's a situation. I was involved with the famous Buster the Bunny episode at the Department of Education when Buster, this cartoon character, was going to go visit a married gay couple in Vermont. And it came to our awareness of the Department of Education. There's a big, you know, scandal. And basically, Margaret Spellings made it clear to PBS that they should pull that show, which they did. Now, there the question was, you know, should three-year-olds be watching a show about a bunny and, you know, suddenly ask, you know, be in the situation where they're asking their parents questions about, you know, well, you know, why does that girl have two mommies? You know, is that appropriate, or should there be some way to warn parents that, hey, this is coming, or this is, it might be sensitive, or this? To me, that seems, well, whatever your thoughts about that, a little different than when we're talking about high school students.
No, they're she's 12. Natalie's 12.
All right. I guess the question is, at what point are you okay with having a kid come home and ask their parents, you know, hey, I learned about this man today and they said he was gay, and what does that mean?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, but I think there's a difference here, because they had a problem with this project because it had to do with human sexuality and AIDS and sexually transmitted diseases, and it had nothing to do with that at all. And there's a difference between, I understand if you don't want your kids to learn about sex, okay, then send a permission slip home, but that's not what this project was about at all.
Right.
So,
yeah. All right. Well, Stafford, thank you for rating that reform and battling through the cold. She is dedicated. She's a tiger. She is like a Cal Ripken type here.
She's a tiger, man.
She's a tiger. All right, Rick. Okay. I feel like that was really meaty this week.
It was. A lot of stuff.
We'll try to be lighter next week.
Indeed.
All right. Until then,
I'm Rick Hess.
And I'm Mike Petrilli of the Education Gadfly Show at edexcellence.net, signing off.